Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Since Donald Trump returned to the White House, eliminating diversity, equity, and inclusion programs has been a priority, not just in federal agencies, but for any organization or institution that receives federal funds. Later in the hour, we talk with a Boston University law professor about the legality of DEI programs, but first we discuss how the dismantling of DEI programs is being felt locally. The town of Falmouth, and specifically the village of Woods Hole, is home to world-renowned scientific research and education institutions. As part of the Woods Hole Diversity Initiative, the Partnership Education Program, or PEP, was conceived as a way to bring underrepresented people into marine and ocean sciences by providing internships and science research opportunities to college students. After nearly two decades, PEP will not be bringing students to Woods Hole this summer. Joining us to talk more about the history of the program, the impact it's had on students, and why it's not happening this year, we welcome Dr. Ambrose Gerald. He served as Director of Academic Programs at NOAA's Northeast Fisheries Science Center in Woods Hole and was the first PEP director. When he began his career back in 1977, he was one of the first Black fisheries biologists at NOAA and the first with a doctorate degree at Northeast Fisheries Science Center. Good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good to see you too, Wendy.
Also with us is Anjali Scott Price. She's director of the Woods Hole Partnership Education Program. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome back.
John Bullard, former president of Sea Education Association. During his tenure at SEA, John was instrumental in the formation of the Woods Hole Diversity Initiative in 2004, under which PEP was created. Welcome back, John. Good to see you.
Mindy, good to be with you by Zoom.
Right. Members of the Woods Hole Diversity Initiative that formed the partnership for the PEP program include the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, the Marine Biological Laboratory, Woodwell Climate Research Center, and Sea Education Association, and two federal agencies, the United States Geological Survey and NOAA Fisheries. We invited representatives from the non-federal partner institutions to join us this morning. They were not able to be in attendance, but we did receive a joint statement from HUI and Woodwell Climate Research, which I will read. PEP has had an important impact, and we remain deeply committed to expanding participation in science. We look forward to continued dialogue about how we as a community can come together and continue to advance this important work. We thank them for that statement. So before we talk about the pausing of PEP, let's start with when and why the Woods Hole Diversity Initiative was created. Ambrose, give us some background on how these different organizations came together. What was the goal of the committee back then?
The organizations came together by my colleague, who's one of the three of us here today, John Bullard. My recall, quite frankly, is John came into Woods Hole as CEO of one of the institutions, and having been the former mayor of New Bedford, knew about the importance of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so got to work right away that whatever time he was to be here, I think, that it would definitely be one that would certainly see that as important to any space.
So John, tell us about the creation of PEP. How was that program first conceived?
Well, when I came to lead Sea Education Association, I got to know SEA, which is a great program teaching college students about the oceans. And but I couldn't help but notice that it was overwhelmingly white. And so I called up Ambrose and said, can I come and have a cup of coffee with you? And we chatted and I said, Ambrose, you know, when I got to City Hall in New Bedford, City Hall was all white. And I set about changing it. And when I worked, when I left City Hall in New Bedford, I went to work at NOAA in Washington, and the Secretary of Commerce was Ron Brown. And Ron Brown taught me that diversity is not a guilt trip. Diversity is a strength. It makes you smarter. And I said, Ambrose, I'm new to Woods Hole. Is SEA the only organization that's white? And because if so, then I'll set about trying to do something about it at SEA. And Ambrose looked at me and, you know, flashed his huge smile and said, no, John. Every one of the scientific organizations here is white because Woods Hole is white and Cape Cod is white. And so we said, well, would it make sense to try and work together to solve this problem, knowing that the issues that we deal with in ocean sciences, you know, whether it's climate change or the production of food or energy, you know, pick any issue you want to talk about, are global. And the world is not white. And we will be smarter as institutions if we reflect the people of the world. And so Ambrose and I said, yeah, it would be better if we tackled this with all of the institutions involved. And so the first person I went to see was Bob Gagosian at HUI. And Bob said, yeah, this is important. And so, you know, we went to George Woodwell, and Ambrose went to see Frank Almeida, who headed the Science Center at the time. And one at a time, we got each of the institutions to sign a memorandum of understanding. It took a while. I mean, I got to Woods Hole in 2002. The memorandum of understanding wasn't signed until July of 2004. But it was the first joint memorandum of understanding that those six institutions had signed. And I thought it was incredibly fitting that that first joint MOU would be on the issue of promoting diversity.
Yeah.
And we set up a diversity action committee, which Ambrose headed. I headed the diversity initiative. And out of the diversity action committee, Ambrose and his colleague George Lyles, one of the projects they created was PEP, and it was revolutionary.
Yeah. So Anjali, tell us more about how the program is structured, and when did the students come, and what do they do while they're here?
Sure. Well, I'd like to back up a little bit and just talk about how we recruit our students.
Yeah, so great idea.
That actually is where I think PEP really differs from other programs, is that we actively recruit from students from underrepresented backgrounds, and we do that in person. So we do visits to HBCUs, or historically Black colleges and universities, or other minority-serving institutions, also called MSIs. And the purpose of doing that is not just to create relationships with students, to bring them in one at a time, but to really foster collaboration with institutions, with faculty members. So it's more than just bringing in students one at a time, that we actually build those relationships and strengthen those relationships between Woods Hole and those institutions. And we go in person. So we don't want to just send flyers and tell students, hey, this is a place that you've historically been excluded from. We want you to come. We go make that effort and really make those connections. And so we recruit those students, and they fill out an application, and our application process is holistic. We don't have minimum GPA requirements. We don't require that students have previous research experience. And quite often we love it when students say, I don't actually know what I want to do. Maybe I just switched over from nursing because I just learned that environmental science was even a career that I could have. And so we look very holistically at students. We look at letters of recommendation. Sometimes we call recommenders and ask them about students who look promising but maybe didn't quite write well about themselves on applications. So we spend a lot of time going through applications before selecting the final cohort, and that's always the most challenging part. So the students generally arrive the end of May, right after Memorial Day. And we have orientation where they meet their mentors for the first time. They give a brief presentation about themselves, and then they start with a four-week research course. And so that course, it historically was taught by different scientists in the Woods Hole community, and recently has been taught by one scientist who brings in other scientists just to expose students to different career fields and different types of research. And students receive four academic credits through our academic partner, which is the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, which is an HBCU. And then the students have their research experience. So each student is matched with a research mentor at one of the research institutions here in Woods Hole, and they conduct some sort of research project. But they're not matched just a student says, I'm interested in underwater volcanoes. We put them with Lauren Molyneux. Not quite how that works. Students will tell us maybe, like I said, what they're interested in, but we look at who the student is and maybe the type of skills that we think they could learn this summer, or maybe get them outside of their box if they've done different types of research. And we're very intentional about who we match them with and who they spend the summers with. And we also require that our mentors attend our DEI training. So that's hosted by a professional who comes in and just spends a half a day. So they don't learn everything, but they at least understand that you may have a student who comes from a different background from you, and there may be cultural differences. And here's how to work through anything that comes up. Here's how to be open with your students. And so so the students do the research experience. Then we also have a lot of career development activities. So how to apply for graduate school. Make sure you don't pay for graduate school. A lot of students don't know that coming in. How to apply for federal jobs. What do careers outside of academia look like? So we try to give them a taste of all of those things. And then we also do a lot of cohort building. So students live together on the SCA campus. We provide them with a grocery card, and they go grocery shopping together, and they cook for each other, and they clean their houses together. Mm-hmm. And they really build that sense of community amongst themselves. Yeah. And then we also take them on field trips. So they go whale watching in Provincetown, to the New Bedford Whaling Museum, to the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology. And in recent years, we started organizing, instead of just having a bus big enough for the PEP students, we would get a 50-passenger bus and invite any student who is in Woods Hole for the summer to join us on those trips to really foster more of a sense of community.
Yeah, I was going to say, boy, what a sense of community. And I think that going in person, you're building that relationship right off the bat, right?
Exactly.
I mean, it's such a powerful thing. Ambrose, you went on a number of those recruiting trips. Talk about some of the schools you visited and how do the faculty and staff, how do they react to the opportunity of this PEP program?
Well, the reaction is one of welcoming, of course. You know, the institutions see as part of their missions as well, providing out-of-classroom experience or academic research experience. So this is a great opportunity. And of course, the institutions, many of which, as Anja's indicated, are minority-serving institutions, which means they have a certain percentage of individuals from what we used to think of as protected classes that make up those universities. So the reception is one of welcoming. I recall going to the University of Texas, El Paso, for example. Wow, you came all the way down here to see us. Not many ever come here or know about us, mm-hmm. you see. So what a welcoming, you know, to be appreciated going there. And then the staff, the scientists, the professionals, they make very definite, you know, preparation for the visit, for mm-hmm. you to meet the staff, meet the faculty, meet the researchers, but more importantly, meet a cross-section of students. You get invited to classes to give a talk, for example, about the program, or to ask questions about what a student's interest in, what goes on in an aquatic environment. So it's one of welcoming and appreciation that someone has their eye on our institution, our students, yeah. and see the importance of our wanting to do science as well, do it well, and of course have opportunities for our students.
And you can see why they'd be excited for you coming. Mm-hmm. We're Absolutely. Discussing the legacy of the Woods Hole Partnership in Education program and its impact on the next generation of scientists. And after a break, we'll hear from a couple of students who went through the program. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing the legacy of the Woods Hole Partnership Education Program, or PEP, and its impact on the next generation of scientists. With us is Dr. Ambrose Gerald. He served as Director of Academic Programs at NOAA's Northeast Fisheries Science Center in Woods Hole and was the first PEP director. Anjali Scott Price is Director of the Woods Hole Partnership Education Program. And John Bullard's former president of Sea Education Association. And during his tenure at SEA, he was instrumental in the formation of the Woods Hole Diversity Initiative in 2004, under which PEP was created. So last week, we spoke with two individuals who went through the Woods Hole Partnership Education Program, Jonathan Nash and Jordan McDavid. Jordan, how did you first learn about the PEP program?
So my grandma, who lives on the vineyard, she knew some people through her sorority group that knew Dr. Gerald, and I was able to get in contact with them and learn about the program.
How about you, Jonathan?
So actually the communications director or specialist, or the case may be, George George Lyles. He came to Hampton University to recruit some of the folks there. It's a yearly thing that they do. So a few of my upperclassmen had went too, and they said it was a really good experience. So I decided to give it a chance.
Yeah. And Jordan, why did you decide to apply, and what year did you participate?
I participated in 2022, and I applied mainly because I needed experience working in the field and just getting to use my hands to do science. So it's a wonderful opportunity.
How about for you, Jonathan? What year were you here?
So I actually went the 2020-2021 year. So it was as we were just coming off COVID. So COVID messed up the back half of my freshman year, and I wasn't able to do research, you know, that summer, of course. So I just needed something that would, you know, give me some experience, you know, outside of just being in class. Yeah, it was just to gain some type of research experience.
Yeah, hands-on, right? You get to do it. So what were some of the standout or unexpected experiences during the program for you, Jonathan?
My program was mainly virtual up until about the last 2 weeks of the internship. They're able to meet our professors and meet the other people in the cohort physically. And they took us around and gave us some things to do. So I would say just how quickly I clicked with the other people in my cohort. I mean, I was only able to really, you know, get to know them for those 2 weeks. And it felt like, you know, I left with a family, and I still have that family today. So, I mean, we see each other at conferences, at different events, we still check up on each other. So that closeness, that connectiveness with, you know, everybody else who's of the same age and in the same cohort was really something that I love and I cherish.
Yeah. How about for you, Jordan?
I have to say, I completely agree. What I wasn't expecting from PEP was how much of a community and a family you form. It was just really amazing how we could all come together and do science. And even more than that, we could be friends. I made some of my greatest friends during PEP, and I'm still friends with them today, to this day. It's just a really amazing community. And usually when you apply to something like this, you don't expect to, or at least I didn't expect to make friends that would last me a lifetime.
So both of you have stayed in touch with some of your PEP cohorts. What about the folks that you met here in Woods Hole? Are you still in touch with them as well?
Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Angie, her husband. It's actually kind of funny because, like, even outside of our own cohorts, we know each other. Like, Jordan was my roommate in Spain.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really matter what year you graduate or you have this you do the PEP program, like, you're going to get to know the other people a part of this alumni chain.
So how has PEP influenced you personally and professionally? Jordan, we'll start with you.
PEP is an amazing start for my scientific career. It was the first internship I participated in, and it really kickstarted my career. Because of PEP and the relationships I made during PEP, I've had the opportunity to go to Spain and present my work at ASLO. I've done field research in Alaska and presented my work at AGU in San Francisco. And if not for PEP and the people I met during that experience, I would not have had any of those experiences. I just think it's really important that programs like this can really jumpstart people's scientific career, because it can be intimidating to start your career, and programs like this really prepare you for what working as a scientist is like, what scientists look like, what doing scientific work is about.
What about for you, Jonathan?
You know, jumping into marine biology, marine and environmental science field, you know, I knew that I would be, like, I'd just be the minority. So being around the PEP program and seeing people who look like me, who have, you know, similar backgrounds, really helped push against my imposter syndrome, per se, of like, am I really supposed to be here? Is this something that I'm really able to do? Similar to Jordan, this was my first experience. And it's really uncommon for internships to accept folks who are, you know, they're underclassmen. So like your freshmen, sophomores, it's really hard for them to get internships and get experience early on. So the fact that the PEP program doesn't necessarily single out juniors and seniors, and they allow for folks of regardless of your age or where you're at in your college journey to be able to join and actually get some experience, it sets up everything. It's your foundation, and it's something that I was able to build on and end up going to other major oceanographic institutes like Scripps. I was able to do a summer program there, and even past that, even in my professional career, I worked for NOAA Fisheries, and they asked me about my experience at PEP. So it just sets up everything and is still helps me now.
So what are your thoughts on the pause of the program, and what would you like the public to know about PEP and similar programs to promote DEI in the sciences? Jonathan, why don't you start?
Well, first, yes, it does push DEI, but I want to make it clear that it didn't single out any one person. There were all races represented within the program. So it's not only minority driven. I want to push that out. Secondly, again, just the experience that you have, the network building, because something I've learned over my years in this field is, you know, yes, it's about what you know, but it's also really about who you know and the opportunities that can be drummed up from the people that you get to be in contact with and really get to know, and the knowledge that they're able to impart with you. So being able to build that network, again, at a very young age, I mean, I was sophomore in college when I did the PEP program, and I'm still able to use those experiences now. I think it's crucial for the next generation, because, I mean, you're seeing now the older generation starting to phase out. It's time for new blood, new scientists, new that next generation to come in. And you can't have that without programs like this.
Right. Jordan, what are your thoughts?
I completely agree. And I think what makes PEP so special is that it fosters such a diverse community. And I think it's really important that we don't lose sight of that. PEP is an amazing start for people. Like we were saying, it's an amazing foundation for people looking to get into the scientific community. It's just really important that programs like these exist, because it can be really hard to put your foot in the door, so to say, when it comes to starting out your career. And these programs really jumpstart and foster excellence when it comes to just performing science. It's definitely a shame to hear about the pause, but I know for a fact that the community that helped give me all of those amazing life-changing experiences will continue to help people and continue to foster that same excellence that we're still performing today.
Jordan McDavid and Jonathan Nash, thank you for sharing your thoughts, and good luck with your careers.
Thank you.
After participating in PEP, Jonathan graduated with a bachelor's in marine and environmental science from Hampton University. Currently, he works for NOAA Fisheries as a consultation biologist. And this past December, Jordan McDavid graduated from the University of Tampa with a bachelor's degree in marine science and biology. And in April, he starts a position as a fisheries observer. All right. So I imagine, as they're saying, you guys stay in touch with a lot of this PEP alumni, right? And is this what you hear, what Jonathan and
Indeed. And this is so refreshing, because their story is the story of, I would say, every single student who came through PEP.
Yeah.
And so, yes.
And they go on to do great things.
They really do. We have students who are faculty members at institutions. We have a PEP alumni who's in the joint program now, one who was back at HUI as a postdoc. We have ones who work for NASA JPL, work for federal government. You know, we have We have some who have been mentors, who have come full circle, have been mentors for PEP students. And I mean, I married one of the PEP students, you know, so I can attest they're awesome.
Yeah. All right. So the pause.
I married one.
Yeah. PEP was paused this year. And we understand that neither you, Anjali, or you, Ambrose, were part of those discussions, right? So
that's correct.
What's your understanding? What happened?
I don't have a full understanding of what happened. I know that there was a meeting that I was invited to, was actually part of the doodle poll of scheduling the meeting, and PEP was on the agenda along with some other things. I have also served as co-chair of the Diversity Advisory Committee for the last couple years, so there was items on the agenda related to that as well. But when I clicked on the meeting link, I received a notice that said, you've been denied access to this meeting. And so I just waited and assumed that maybe some of the other agenda items were taking longer, although I will say in the past year or so, I've attended the DI meetings from start to finish. So I honestly didn't think anything of it and just thought, oh, the other agenda items have taken longer and somebody would get back to me. And throughout the week, myself as co-chair of the DAC and the chair of the DAC had emailed the chair of the DI and said, well, we need to talk about several things, not just PEP, but we have these Black History Month events that are happening. And we generally promote our Juneteenth events, and we want to make sure that there's still budget for these things. There's just lots of things to talk about. And, you know, we received a reply that our email had been received, but nothing substantial. And I received a message on Thursday evening asking from someone on the DI asking to speak with them. And on Friday morning, they told me that the DI had decided to cancel PEP. And I was very confused. And I said, but we have a plan. This can't be just a financial issue, because we had a fundraising plan and we were actually 30% to our goal. And we had mentors who said they were still happy to host, and we still had housing at SCA. Like, there were things that were still in place. And I was told the decision was final. And I mean, there was some more conversation that was had, and that was how I found out about it. And I said, well, I don't have anything in writing, admittedly, so I'm going to continue with what I'm doing. And I was told, well, there's a statement that will be coming out shortly. And then within a few hours, there was a statement that I think has now pretty much become public that was sent out at the institutions.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Wes, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's too bad that it happened the way it did. It was without transparency. It was without consultation or collaboration by the key stakeholders. And to me, that is a failure of leadership. And of course, it hurts from my point mm-hmm. of view,
yeah.
Because I see that we spent more than 20 years with just PEP as part of the DI, building relationships, building trust, building inclusiveness, mm-hmm. and here in a flash, all of that was squandered.
Yeah.
Let alone to mention the resources, human resources, the time, the commitment put in, the networks built, the relationships with the institutions, etc., here and beyond. And so it did not have to end this way. It did not have to end. And so here again, I see this as exclusionary. It's an opportunity where people go into a room, look around, and never ask, perhaps, why are we in an all-white space here making these kinds of decisions for Black and brown people and white people, mm-hmm. you see? And so in a flash, they either forgot everything that we stood for and that we were trying to do and squandered it. Mm-hmm. And so while there, you know, there's the opportunity to continue, and we will continue. But the point is, trust has been broken now. Yeah. It's been broken yeah. with among the various people who committed, including the staff, including our academic and external partners. So again, we're in a position now where so much has been squandered in a heartbeat, so to say. And you think that leaders or leadership is astute enough to learn from its past and commit to principles that it espouses. But here again, in a flash, all of that is dashed.
Yeah. John, what are your thoughts?
I share exactly what Angie and Ambrose have said. Ambrose has said in describing PEP that everyone is in Woods Hole because they know somebody. And what we've tried to do with PEP is to create a network, and you heard that with Jonathan and Jordan, where there would be a network developed over time where people would know somebody. But that meant that we were doing PEP as a long game. 17 students is not a lot, but 17 students a year for year after year after year eventually builds that network. And we had no expectation that everyone who went through PEP would come back to Woods Hole. We didn't care about that. You know, maybe they end up, you know, in Seattle. Maybe they end up in Miami. Maybe they end up at Scripps. We didn't care as long as they end up in the marine sciences somewhere. But it was the long game. And so a pause is very dangerous. I remember, like it was yesterday, the conversation I had with Bob Gagosian recruiting Huey into the diversity initiative. And it was clear to me as I talked to Bob, who was a great leader for Huey, that they would be interested in the diversity initiative as long as it didn't conflict with other work they were doing. And they could, and all the other institutions, support the diversity initiative back then in 2004 because it was a both and situation. They could do diversity and all the other good work they were doing. It didn't conflict with other work. Now we're in a different situation. All the institutions, I worked at NOAA for 10 years. All look at diversity as something that if we do this, we are going to lose. We are going to have things taken away from us. And they are saying, we don't want these research grants taken away from us. We depend on all these research grants. People are being intimidated. Law firms are being intimidated. Universities are being intimidated. Businesses like the Washington Post are being intimidated. Very powerful people are being intimidated. And so you look at our national anthem, land of the free, home of the brave, and you say, well, if we're not the land of the free, are we the home of the brave? And when you come at the cancellation of PEP, and nobody willing to stand up and say, this is important, we need to keep it going. I know when I look at Angie and Ambrose, we're the home of the brave with Angie and Ambrose, but I look at other people and say, where are the brave?
We're going to post links with more information about the Partnership Education Program and the Woods Hole Diversity Initiative at our website, capeandislands.org. Ambrose Gerald, John Bullard, Anjali, Scott Price, thank you so much. And let's hope it's a pause and not the end. Thank you. Coming up after break, we're going to talk with Jonathan Vingold, Associate Professor of Law at Boston University School of Law, about the legality of DEI programs. You're listening to The Point. Joining us now is Jonathan Vingold, Associate Professor of Law at Boston University School of Law. Welcome.
Thanks, Mindy. So glad to be with you.
So we invited you here today because we wanted to talk about public institutions and private organizations outside of the federal government complying with federal directives like one ending DEI programs. There's a term for this, anticipatory compliance. Talk about how the Trump administration has effectively rolled back DEI programs, even in non-federal agencies.
So I think what we heard at the end of the last conversation you were having was right on point. You essentially have the Trump administration through this endless flurry of executive actions that are essentially threats, part of an effort to extort any entity, private or public, that is doing anything that the Trump administration disfavors. And The term anticipatory obedience, I think, is incredibly appropriate. And I think it likely applies to the PEP context, which I was not familiar with, but just hearing the story, it's this moment in which you have the Trump administration say, I'm going to come after you if you do something that I don't like. And regardless of the legality of what someone is doing, folks are folding. We've seen this across university contexts and other places as well. And it's really dispiriting because it is just a reflection of the fact that many of the folks in leadership right now don't seem to be wanting to fight.
So what is illegal DEI as defined by the Trump administration?
So there is no illegal DEI. Illegal DEI is a term that was in one of the Trump administration's executive orders. I think what's important to know is that two executive orders that Trump issued in early into his administration, they were racist, they were sexist, they said a lot of things, they clearly indicated an intent to target political opponents, but they did not change the law on civil rights. They did not change Title VI, they did not change Title VII or Title IX, the primary laws that would prohibit discrimination in universities and public and private entities. And under existing law, my guess is almost all of the sort of existing equity and diversity styled programs across the country are either wholly defensible or largely legally defensible. And so I was part of a group of leading legal of law professors who about a month ago wrote a memo that we sent to over 600 universities where we just wanted to remind them that what you are doing now, it's common, it's standard, it complies with law. And we urge you to fight because you're not just sort of on the side of the law. It's also morally principled for you to be taking modest steps to, you know, cultivate inclusive environments, to combat bias, and build institutions that are actually going to enable you to realize your core mission, which is to produce truth and knowledge for the common good.
Yeah. I'm sort of curious your thoughts on, you know, a lot of these universities have really big endowments, right? So this threat of taking money away, you would think really might not impact them, right? Because of the endowments they have. So why do it?
So it's a really good question. And I think it's important to note that one of the reasons why universities have not been defending their principals and their people is because most of our institutions are very anti-democratic in the ways that they are structured, where formal power resides in small, often lay, unaccountable boards of trustees whose interests often diverge from that of the people who make up the institution, the workers, faculty and staff, and students. Because what we've heard from the beginning from, you know, the majority of individuals who comprise these institutions is that you should fight. Like, we know that the Trump administration is coming for us. We see from places in New York that if you try to satiate that, like, lust, they're just going to, you know, take over everything. And so particularly with the most well-resourced institutions, to not be fighting, it's hard not to read that as apathy, because like, and a failure to appreciate that these often modest and incomplete commitments to creating more diverse, equitable, and inclusive institutions, they're not some, you know, complement to what happens in the institution, but they're actually essential for it, and that the university cannot realize its mission unless it is doing so, unless it is ensuring that everyone, regardless of who they are, is able to enter and engage in that really critical knowledge production process.
The attorneys generals of 16 states signaled to private employers that their DEI programs can remain legal if designed and implemented correctly under applicable laws. What are the key? What are the key design and implementation points?
So one thing just to keep in mind is you have states like California that since the mid-90s have been living under legal regimes that essentially mirror what the Supreme Court did nationally in the Harvard and UNC litigation a couple of years ago, which was in the admissions context to prohibit institutions from using racial identity as a formal criterion in competitive admissions processes. In states like California, for two decades now, have been engaged in all sorts of creative and lawful efforts to avowedly pursue racial diversity, gender diversity, racial inclusion. through all sorts of different means. And so in this memo that we sent out, we had an inexhaustive list of 13 different like types of programs. Now, none of these programs are using sort of race or gender as a formal criterion, though even many programs that do are legally defensible. And what is so, disheartening again is that you have institutions that are just failing to defend the work that they do when that work is so important and when it is consistent with law. Now, of course, it's possible that under our current Supreme Court, like this Supreme Court goes even further in sort of co-opting civil rights laws to undermine civil rights remedies, but we're not there yet. And as recently as last year, the Supreme Court showed no interest in striking down policies that were explicitly designed to promote racial diversity, but we're not using race as a formal criterion. And so like recruitment efforts, inclusion efforts, retention efforts that are attentive to the ways in which racism and sexism enter our institutions, differentially situate individuals, that's wholly lawful. But it's also like just basically necessary. Like, what are we doing if we're not attending to some of the most powerful forces that continue to undermine, you know, our most modest goals as an aspiring multiracial democracy?
So what types of DEI practices are most likely to come under scrutiny then under this current administration?
Everything.
Everything, right?
Yeah. Everything. I mean, like we have reports now, I think it was out of Idaho, where a teacher was forced to take down a poster in her classroom that said, "Everyone is welcome." Yeah. And that poster had a bunch of hands on it of a range of colors. And the school administrator, who seems clearly aligned with a sort of Trump MAGA anti-DEI ideology, what they said is like, sure, the message "everyone is welcome," that's okay. But when you have, you know, hands, some that are whiter, some that are darker, that's when things get problematic. And so I really think it is like key to like make clear that the Trump administration's attack is not based on some nuanced sort of analysis of what the law is. It is part of a literal make America great again vision of the United States, which is to try to bring us back to a pre-civil rights era in which all positions of power were held by people who were male and who were white, and which that was justified on the basis of what remain pervasive stereotypes about women, about people of color, Black women in particular. And it's just very important to recognize that what the Trump administration is doing is like an openly racist and sexist attack on, again, modest efforts to just try to, you know, a couple years ago, we were saying we have to reckon with racism. Trump administration doesn't want us to do that.
So what are the biggest legal risks for institutions implementing DEI programs?
So on the one hand, everyone now confronts the risk of an authoritarian administration that is going to continue leveraging the full power of the federal government against entities that do anything that they don't like. And that's not, it's almost awkward to ask what's the legal risk, because we see judges that are being attacked. We see universities that are being attacked. We see civil society organizations that are being attacked. And so I think it's like important to be clear-eyed that entities that continue to promote multiracial democracy, they're going to be attacked. Now, legally, as like under Title VI, universities that are targeted by the Trump administration with the claim that somehow some DEI initiative violates Title VI, there's actually procedural requirements that the Trump administration would have to go through before it can just simply pull federal funding. Can't legally, you know, just Trump can't snap his fingers and say, we're going to take these millions of dollars away because you are allegedly violating the civil rights law. What we just haven't seen yet is universities actually leverage, you know, the process that they're entitled to in ways that, again, are like, it's curious. It's hard to understand, but it's something that, you know, they could be doing.
So have any federal grant recipients challenged the federal ban on DEI, or do you anticipate that this will be challenged in court?
Yeah, so maybe a couple weeks ago now, a group of entities sued, I believe, in a Maryland district court to strike down President Trump's executive orders targeting equity, diversity, and inclusion. A trial court judge issued an injunction that halted the executive orders, though note that even after the injunction, you continue to have entities, pull back on their efforts. Quite recently, within the past couple of days, an appellate court in the Fourth Circuit, unless I'm misremembering, pulled the injunction, meaning that the executive order is able to remain in effect pending the litigation. This wasn't a ruling on the merits, but the judges, which included some Democratic appointees, said that for various reasons they were not comfortable in joining the litigation. Something that I'll note that I've been vocal about in other places is one of my concerns with respect to this litigation is many of the challenges are rooted in sort of First Amendment type challenges, that this is viewpoint discrimination or due process type challenges, that the executive order is vague. What we haven't seen are claims that are challenging the executive order is itself discriminatory, because it is clearly motivated to undermine Black inclusion. It is clearly predicated on like quite naked and transparent presumptions about Black and female incompetence. And like there's a clear path to challenge these laws on that basis, and the failure to do so just limits the ability to tell a complete story and to sort of articulate a full like legal reason why these laws, the executive orders, it's not just that they don't change the law, but they're themselves legally fraught because they're part of a broader anti-Black movement.
So, what could be the costs of a legal battle with the federal government on these programs?
Yes, you can think of it in a couple ways. One is that, so universities, for example, universities, like they don't like bad press, they don't like being in the news, and they don't want to have to spend money on various things. Litigation does cost money. But there's a much bigger cost to not fighting. The bigger cost is you lose your independence as an institution. You lose your integrity as an institution. And if you lose your independence, then you're not able to realize your most basic mission. But there are also ways to limit cost. And one thing that you have seen, again, from university faculty increasingly is a call for university leaders to work collectively in solidarity with one another, to not just like continue to chase rankings or have the best PR, but to figure out how to engage in some mutual defense pact, like a NATO, where you commit to leveraging collective resources in a way that protects everyone and their independence from a Trump administration that is systematically trying to pick folks off one at a time, because like that's how you get everyone. But like it's the same with respect to individuals and institutions. If we work together, there's no reason why we can't protect ourselves from, but again, it's an open like a coup on the country.
Yeah. Just have about a minute left. And one of the things
Sure.
I'm wondering if you have any final thoughts. I think a lot of people are feeling really frustrated, but it doesn't seem like we're hearing much of an outcry. And I'm thinking fear might be a factor there. People maybe fear stepping. What do people need to do?
So fear is the point. The point is fear. And many of our leaders have not been speaking out, which is immobilizing. But it's just important to remember a lot of people feel the same way you do. And so, talking with your neighbors, speaking out with your neighbors, speaking directly at your elected officials and letting them know that you're angry at them for not speaking out. There is power in our collective voice, and there's increasing opportunities to make ourselves heard, you, me, and everyone else.
All right. Jonathan Feingold is Associate Professor of Law at Boston University School of Law. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us. Appreciate that.
Thanks, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
By Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.